If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Who was the world's first assassin? How have assassination methods changed through history? And do assassinations generally achieve their aims? Well, in today's podcast episode, you'll be hearing from historian John Withington, who analysed 266 assassinations for his new book, Assassin's Deeds, A History of Assassination from Ancient Egypt to the Present Day. He spoke about some of history's most notorious killings to our digital section editor, Rachel Dinning.
So I thought we could start the podcast with you giving us a definition of what an assassin is. When is a killing an assassination? And, you know, it's not just a murder, it is an assassination.
Well, I looked at things like the Cambridge and Oxford dictionaries, and I came to the conclusion that all assassinations are murders, but not all murders are assassinations. And so the kind of working definition that I've used for the book is that assassination is the killing of someone powerful, important, or famous because they're powerful, important, or famous. So if it was, say, a crime of passion, that wouldn't necessarily be an assassination. I felt that assassination had a kind of sudden, out-of-the-blue quality to it, which would not apply to someone who was already in the custody of the person who did away with them. So, for example, I didn't consider that Edward II or Richard II were assassinated, though both of them may have been murdered. I didn't consider that Charles I was assassinated, though he was, of course, executed. So that was why I've gone for that particular definition. I appreciate not everybody will agree with my definition, but I felt it was something where you had to draw a line somewhere. And I had this notion that the kind of sudden out-of-the-blue quality was part of assassination.
So you've considered dozens, if not hundreds of cases for your book, Assassin's Deeds. And having looked at such a such a comprehensive overlook, you go from the, you know, ancient world, ancient Egypt, right through to modern day. Can you say, having looked at all of these different time periods, that assassination was more prevalent in certain parts of the world or in certain cultures? When were you most at risk of being assassinated, I suppose, is my question.
I looked at 266 assassinations, and so the short answer is I've not got any kind of risk profile of when you were most at risk of being assassinated. Oddly, I did look at the geography of assassinations. It so happens that Italy came out as the assassination capital in the 260 that I looked at. I think there were 30 in Italy, but a large number of those, I think it was about 23, were in the Roman Empire. Also, the majority that I looked at were in Europe. But again, that may be more to do just with the fact that we've got better information about those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. When I was reading your book, the chapter that looked at the Roman period in particular, that was the chapter where I was like, you know what, if I was a leader, I really wouldn't want to be a leader in the Roman Empire. I feel like the risk of being assassinated or stabbed in the back is far, far too great.
I think you're right. And there was, it was a Russian who said about the Russian Empire that their method of government was despotism tempered by assassination. But actually, that was far more true of the Roman Empire. The problem with the Roman Empire was that there were no rules of succession, really. The Roman Empire just kind of appeared. And so they had to kind of make it up as they went along. And there was no rule as to who was going to be the next emperor. And 17 were the ones I looked at, 17 assassinations. 15 of those were carried out by the emperor's own bodyguard or by his own troops. And it was Augustus, the first Roman emperor, who said the most terrible thing is that most people have to be afraid of their enemies, but we emperors have to be afraid of our friends and those closest to us.
One thing that I found particularly interesting was you sort of discussed the ethics of assassination, which sounds a bit paradoxical. But there's been various philosophers over the years who've, you know, they've posited this argument that actually assassination, if you're wanting to get rid of a tyrant, is an ethical way of doing it because you're just, you know, you're killing one person as opposed to going to war and risking hundreds of thousands of, you know, deaths. How have people seen assassination through history in ethical terms?
Well, there was this notion of tyrannicide, that if a ruler is a tyrant, if they abuse their position, then they lose their moral authority. And then some people held, including Plato, for example, that it was then legitimate to kill them, to hence tyrannicide. And so that goes back to ancient Greece at least, possibly earlier, but we certainly know that it was being talked about in ancient Greece. And that notion got quite a boost, actually, at the time of the Reformation, because the Reformation divided Christendom into two warring factions, essentially, the Catholics and the Protestants, who each saw the other lot as heretics. And so the notion of tyrannicide got quite a revival at that time. And in the French Wars of Religion, for example, so Henry III and Henry IV of France were both killed by extreme Catholics. And William the Silent, the leader of the Dutch revolt against the Netherlands, against the Spanish Empire in the 16th century, he too was killed by a Roman Catholic fanatic. So that was one notion, the idea of tyrannicide. As you say, the other one, quite an interesting one, which the great Chinese writer, if Sun Tzu anyway, he was a great general. Nobody's entirely sure whether he actually wrote the famous book, The Art of War, but it's been credited to him. So Sun Tzu, he was the person who argued that assassination was more cost effective. So going to war is a terribly expensive thing. So if you can just kill your enemy, an individual, an important individual, that's much more economical. And out of that grew the notion that you've talked about, this idea that actually there's also, it's also morally better just to kill the important leader on the opposite side rather than to kill thousands of ordinary soldiers. And of course, in war, it's not just soldiers who get killed. It's nearly always ordinary citizens as well. So those were the kind of some of the ethical arguments that went on about assassination.
And of course, we've already touched on how assassinations could be, you know, it could be that your own bodyguard that turns on you or is bribed by someone. What sort of steps would people take? What would you, if you were a king or an emperor or something, how do you sort of prevent this from happening?
So bodyguards was one way of doing it. And that's one that's gone back, I suppose, you know, to the very earliest of times. But as we said, if you looked at those Roman emperors that I talked about, out of 17, 15 were murdered by their own troops or their own bodyguards. There's been more technological approaches taken more recently, of course. So Eduard Shevardnadze, the president of Georgia, in 1998, there was an attempt made on him when he was driving in his armor-plated car, and his armor-plated car saved his life. But the armor-plated car did not save the life of a German industrialist called Alfred Herrhausen, who was blown up in 1989 by the Red Army faction, often known as the Baader-Meinhof gang. In the 1950s, the French had rather an interesting approach. So there are a lot of Russian émigrés in France who left Russia at the time of the revolution, didn't much like the communist regime. So in the 1950s in France, if Soviet dignitaries were visiting, these potential troublemakers among the émigrés would be very strongly advised and invited to go and stay in an expensive country hotel at the expense of the French government while the Russian visitors were in the country. You talked about the steps people take. In some ways, the more interesting thing is the steps people don't take. So Abraham Lincoln, the night he was assassinated, his regular bodyguard was off doing another job, and he had a stand-in bodyguard who had already been reprimanded, I think, for falling asleep on duty. And Lincoln let his stand-in bodyguard go off for a drink. And so when John Wilkes Booth arrived at the presidential box to shoot him, there was no bodyguard to be seen.
And I suppose that kind of brings me on to like one of the biggest questions with your book, which is, do assassinations work? It sounds a bit of a weird question, but as someone who's analysed hundreds of assassinations, all committed for various reasons, are most of them successful if you had to come down on one side or the other? Do assassins generally achieve their aims?
Well, as I said, I analysed 266 assassinations. Now, all of them worked in the sense that the victim died. But what I tried also to analyse is whether the assassin would have been happy with the outcome of the assassination. Disraeli, for example, said after Lincoln's assassination that assassination never works. Well, for what it's worth, and this is plainly a very subjective decision, isn't it? How, you know, trying to evaluate would a particular assassin have been happy with this particular outcome? But for what it's worth, I made a judgment in about 215 cases, and the judgment I made was that in about 132, the assassin would have been happy. But in 83, they would not have been happy. There was a study, actually, that an American team did in 2007. This is slightly more precise than the one that I did. They looked at 300 assassination attempts, and they looked at a sort of narrower question than I did, really. And they concluded that killing democratic leaders had very little effect, but that if you assassinated an autocrat, that had a 13% greater chance of that country transitioning to democracy if the plot succeeded than if it failed.
What's an example of an assassination where it had perhaps unintended consequences? So maybe the assassin succeeded in killing their target, but you might consider the assassination to be a failure in terms of how things unfolded afterwards, if that makes sense.
I suppose in a way, the classic example of unintended consequences was perhaps the assassination of Franz Ferdinand. Now, there are arguments about whether that, quotes, caused the First World War or not, but it's certainly was an important factor in kicking off the First World War. So you couldn't have a much more momentous consequence. And although there are arguments, or some historians will argue, well, the First World War was going to happen anyway. But what we do know is that at least some of the assassins who'd killed Franz Ferdinand felt that they were responsible for the First World War. And one of them said, if I'd known what was going to happen, I would have sat down on our bombs and blown myself to bits. So I don't think any of those assassins who killed Franz Ferdinand believed this was going to lead to the most dreadful conflict the world had seen up to that point. So that's a pretty sobering unintended consequence. I'm reminded of what Gandalf, I think, says in The Lord of the Rings when he's...
Oh, I love a Lord of the Rings reference.
I think that... aren't they arguing about whether they should kill Gollum? And Gandalf says, proceed very carefully, because not all ends are known even to the wise. That Franz Ferdinand is a terribly sobering example of that. Another thing that often happens, of course, is that you turn the victim into a martyr. Perhaps the classic case was Thomas Becket's murder. So a fairly routine struggle between church and state in 12th century Europe, you know, that happened the whole time. The church was a powerful institution. The monarchy was a powerful institution. Very often in a number of countries, they were at loggerheads. And apart from Becket's assassination, there was a very similar one where a Polish archbishop was murdered in very, very similar circumstances by his king, possibly at his king's own hand. But that both he and Becket then became martyrs. And Becket, of course, became one of the most revered martyrs in Christendom. King Henry II, when he found out that his knights had killed Becket, even though they may have said that he kind of told them to, he went into solitude for 3 days, not quite knowing what to do, I think. And by the time he had emerged from this solitude, Becket was already an international figure, a martyr. You know, people were already attributing miracles to him. They dipped their handkerchief in his blood and said that it had had these miraculous qualities. So creating martyrs is certainly perhaps an even more striking example than Becket was a man called Edward the Martyr, who was a young king of England, who was not obvious saintly material. He was prone to the most violent rages, and people close to him were terrified of him. But in 978, he was assassinated, and he immediately became Saint Edward. There are churches named after him, and he became a martyr. And his status as a martyr undermined the prestige of his successor, who became known to history as Ethelred the Unready.
We've already talked a bit about what people could do to protect themselves against assassination if you were a leader. It almost seems like one protection would be making yourself loved by the people, so that, you know, the protection of if all the people love you, they're going to be pretty furious if you end up dead. So that's a disincentive to try and knock you off your spot.
Yes. Well, that was what Machiavelli advocated. Machiavelli, of course, regarded as the most cynical of all political thinkers. But one of the things he said, yes, is make yourself loved by the people, and then no assassin will dare to move against you. Maybe, though, making yourself loved by all of the people is easier said than done. So probably if you're a leader, it's probably pretty hard to get unanimous approval from all of the people. I think another point about unintended consequences is that, take, for example, Martin Luther King and JF Kennedy. Now, both of their deaths, both of their murders are shrouded in controversy to this day, with arguments about who really did it, and if they did it, who was behind them. But I think one thing we can be fairly confident about is that those who wanted Martin Luther King or JFK dead were probably not supporters of the civil rights movement. But I think it's generally felt that their deaths actually did contribute to the advancement of the civil rights movement in America.
I was hoping that we could maybe look at some cases in more depth. Maybe a good place to start would be you telling our listeners who the first known assassination is, or as far as we understand it to be anyway.
The first one I could find was an Egyptian pharaoh called Teti, who was assassinated about 4,300 years ago. But I know how well informed your podcast listeners are, so maybe somebody's found an earlier one. I'd be very interested to hear if they have. But this was the earliest one I could find. And an ancient Egyptian historian wrote about it about 300 BC. So 2,000 years after it happened, but possibly drawing on sources that have since been lost to us. And the historian said that Teti was, quote, murdered by his bodyguard. In addition to this, though, there is also some circumstantial evidence. And the circumstantial evidence is that a number of senior officials had their memorials defaced or their remains moved after their deaths. And this, in ancient Egypt, was a terrible punishment because it meant that you would wander homeless in the afterlife. We know that Teti had come to power at a time of considerable turbulence, and we also knew that he beefed up his security. He got more bodyguards, though that may be backfired.
What are the most popular weapons used in assassinations? And I suppose, have there been any notable changes across history in this regard?
Well, up to about the end of the 19th century, stabbing was certainly the number one method. And it was only really overtaken, as I say, around about the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. And then firearms took over. And so I looked at 100 assassinations from the beginning of the First World War to the present day, and 66 of those involve using firearms. But interestingly, we often think of the Day of the Jackal, don't we? That's the Jackal, perhaps the most famous assassin in literature, who was a sniper, of course. But actually, although firearms was the most popular, they were very rarely snipers. It was nearly always the handgun at close quarters rather than the sniper's rifle. But certainly, yes, in recent times, that's been the big technological change, is that the gun has taken over from stabbing. Next most popular in recent times was the bomb. So explosive used in 18 out of the 100 assassinations I looked at in the modern age. Poison has had longevity. So poison was being used in the very, very earliest assassinations and still being used. As we know, Sergei Skripal survived, and Alexander Litvinenko recently. So poison had possibly a bit of a revival. Peculiar thing about bombs, though, bombs almost not used at all, really, until about 1880, when Tsar Alexander II of Russia was assassinated by a bomb in 1881. But explosives made a very strange, mysterious appearance in 1567 in the murder of Lord Darnley, who was the estranged husband of Mary, Queen of Scots. And in circumstances which are still baffling to this day, Lord Darnley, the house where Lord Darnley was staying in Edinburgh, was blown up by gunpowder. And Lord Darnley was found dead in the grounds, but he'd been strangled.
So fascinating. It's like, did someone murder him, then try and cover it up? Did the explosion not work and someone had to dispatch him afterwards? There's loads of questions, isn't there? Was Mary, Queen of Scots, involved, is my question.
Certainly many people suspected that she was. But if I remember rightly, there was a forensic examination in the fairly recent past, the last 10 years or so, which I think concluded that she probably wasn't. I think that was the conclusion. But it's you know, it's hard enough, isn't it, for forensic experts to solve murders often if they've happened a couple of weeks ago. So when it's
trying to do it across the centuries,
450 years ago,
another challenge. You mentioned about how when we think of being assassinated by gun, we think sniper, because that's sort of the stereotypical image that we've got of an assassin. That's, you know, Hollywood has sort of had a part in creating this image. And on that note, is our modern idea of an assassin, are we completely off the mark? When you think of assassin, you might think of an anti-James Bond type figure who's been highly trained, moves in the shadows. You know, the kind of image of an assassin that I'm thinking of.
I mentioned The Jackal, The Day of the Jackal, and I think The Jackal is arguably the most famous assassination. And I don't want to give too much away to people who've not read the book, but he has a number of characteristics. Three characteristics strike me about The Jackal. One is meticulous planning. A large part of the book is about the extraordinarily detailed, careful, meticulous planning that goes into the assassination plan. The second thing is, it's strictly business. He has been hired to murder President de Gaulle of France, and he's doing it because he's been paid a lot of money. And the third thing is, he tries to do it as a sniper, tries to shoot him from a distance. Now, as I say, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but he fails. In spite of the meticulous planning, he fails. So how typical are those three factors? Meticulous planning, strictly business, done from a distance. Most assassination attempts are not as well planned as that. And you get very peculiar things like when the Emperor, I mentioned the Empress Elizabeth, when she was assassinated in Geneva, she was the second choice victim, kind of off the substitute's bench. The assassin, an Italian anarchist, had gone to Geneva to try to assassinate somebody else, and he didn't show up. And then the assassin found that the Empress Elizabeth was in town and thought, well, while I'm here, I might as well kill her. So the meticulously planned assassination is not as common as you might think. The strictly business is, again, relatively unusual. 266 assassinations that I analysed, and 18 were hired assassins who had no particular ideological motive. They were just doing it because they were paid. Only 18. And only 19 of the killings were not done at close quarters. So it was with stabbing, you pretty well got to get up close and personal. But even with guns, it was the handgun at close quarters rather than the sniper at a distance. And there's some good reasons for that. You know, in The Day of the Jackal, what happens? It's been beautifully planned. The jackal shoots absolutely the right shot in the perfect position. And just at the crucial moment, President de Gaulle bends down to kiss the cheek of a war veteran and the bullet misses. And that really happened in real life. In 1800, King George III of England was in the London Theatre and somebody took a pot shot at him. And just as the shot went off, George III bowed his head to acknowledge the applause of the audience, and the shot missed. So sniping is very, very difficult. I think also assassination is difficult. You know, I keep mentioning Franz Ferdinand, but it's such a significant assassination. There were six assassins around the route that Franz Ferdinand took, and only one of them managed to actually throw a bomb at him.
And again, that this was a case, they didn't actually succeed in their initial plan. They did have a plan, but they didn't succeed in that. And it was only an opportunistic moment later that day.
That's absolutely correct. And the interesting thing about Franz Ferdinand is that actually it was relatively well planned. There were six assassins deployed along his route. There was a floating assassin who went between the other assassins, offering support, making sure everything was going according to plan. They'd been given cyanide pills to take. It was pretty well planned operation. But on that on Franz Ferdinand's first pass in his open top car, only one of them actually managed to do anything. One of them threw a bomb which hit the car and injured some of Franz Ferdinand's retinue, though neither he nor his wife was injured. A couple of the would-be assassins tried to take their cyanide pills when the crowd chased after them, but the cyanide pills were past their use-by date, and so it didn't work. Anyway, it looked as though the whole thing had been a failure, and one of the assassinations, called Prinkip, had gone to a cafe to bemoan the apparent failure of their attempt. Meanwhile, Franz Ferdinand decided that he wished to go to hospital to visit the member of the retinue who'd been injured. And so, against advice from some people, he set out again in the open-top car with his wife to go to the hospital. But the person who'd been injured was the organizer. He'd organized the trip, organized the motorcade. And with him out of the way, unfortunately, there was a mix-up and they took a wrong turning and the cars all came to a halt. And Prinkip was in his cafe bemoaning what had happened, looked outside, and there was Franz Ferdinand's car parked outside the cafe.
He couldn't believe his luck.
Went out and shot Franz Ferdinand and his wife dead.
Mm-hmm. Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
It all worked perfectly. 8th of November 1939, the time bomb went off exactly at the time that Georg Elser had planned. It brought down the ceiling on the speaker's podium, killed 8 people, but Hitler wasn't there, because World War II had broken out by that point and Hitler had had to change his schedule. And so by the time the bomb exploded, he had left the building 13 minutes before.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of 5-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
It's such an interesting case because it was the complete opposite of this slick operation they'd planned. And Franz Ferdinand's death came about because of a bout of good luck, really. So one thing I'm curious about is the character profile of assassins more generally. You've studied 266 cases. Can you identify any common personality traits amongst these killers? Who is most likely to become an assassin?
Men. So of the 266 assassinations that I looked at, only 9 women were involved. So that's the first and probably the clearest thing you can say. There was an interesting profiling study done in the United States in 1999, and they looked at 83 would-be assassins over a period of about 50 years. And they didn't come up with simple answers, but they were mainly white men. Half of them were single, 47 of them, so more than half had no children. And 29, interestingly, had at some point threatened to kill themselves. So they give a word of caution. They say that there is, quote, no single profile. But one thing that they did find in common was often a difficulty in coping with life's problems. And they said, and I found this a very eye-catching phrase, those who see themselves doing well in life rarely attempt assassinations.
Interesting. So the sort of idea that assassination is undertaken by sort of a lone wolf, a person slightly on the outskirts of society, in this study sort of has a little bit of backing, I suppose.
Yes. Again, I found that of my 266 assassinations, 58 were carried out by lone assassins, though even some of them had help or financial support from a wider network. I suppose if you want to look at the classic kind of lone wolf, I suppose Mark Chapman, you know, who killed John Lennon in 1980, he was a classic kind of lone wolf, did it completely off his own bat, no one else involved in the project, made easier, of course, by the fact that John Lennon had no bodyguard. Was Lee Harvey Oswald a lone assassin? We don't know, but he may have been. But I think, as I've said before, assassination is complicated and difficult. We talked about Franz Ferdinand. You know, that it required the most extraordinary stroke of luck for those assassins to kill him, and so I suppose the reason that comparatively few are lone assassins is that if you've got a planned, particularly a political objective, it often requires a wider network of people in order to have a better chance of success.
You say that most assassins are men, but do we have any interesting examples of female killers through history?
I think the earliest woman assassin that I write about is a poisoner called Locusta. In ancient Rome, an artist in poisons, they said. She was operating around about 50 AD, and she was alleged to have killed the Emperor Claudius and his son, among others. She was also rewarded with large estates in the country by Nero for her trouble. But she, in the end, justice caught up with her, and she was executed by Nero's successor. Actually, coming right to the almost the present day, almost the most recent assassination that I write about in the book is the one, very peculiar one, that happened in 2017 in Kuala Lumpur Airport, where Kim Jong Nam, the disgraced brother of the North Korean dictator, was killed by an Indonesian woman and a Vietnamese woman who said that they thought they were taking part in some kind of television reality show, and that they'd been told to rub this cream on his face as a prank, and the cream unfortunately contained a deadly nerve agent which killed Kim Jong Nam. So they are, I think, the only two assassins that I write about who successfully claim to have been duped. I mean, they claim that they were duped into doing what they did, and both have now been released from prison.
I was actually going to ask you about strange assassinations, because you do cover quite a number in your book. Perhaps you can give our listeners some examples of some, you know, frankly bizarre cases that you came across.
Well, there are lots of failed bizarre ones. And I think there was an attempt to use an exploding toothpaste tube against an African leader, for example. But in terms of bizarre assassination attempts that succeeded, one of the most weird, the victim was a man called Jörg Jenatsch, who was one of the leading Swiss figures in the 30 Years' War, that terrible conflict that disfigured Central Europe for three decades. It happened in 1639 during a carnival, and a crowd of people in fancy dress surrounded Jenatsch, and Jenatsch had people with him, and they thought it was all good-natured. And then one of this crowd, who was dressed as a bear, produced an axe and hacked Jenatsch to death. Perhaps even more weird, though, if we go back about 1,000 years, so 995, King Kenneth II of Scotland had put to death the son of a woman called Lady Finella. And Lady Finella saw the king out hunting one day. And Lady Finella, unbeknown to the king, had been hired by his enemies. And Lady Finella went to see the king and said her son had deserved his fate and she was very sorry for what he'd done. And would the king please come to her house, because she wanted to tell him about plots against him. And also she had a very nice little figurine, a statuette that she would like to show to him. And he was a bit iffy about it, but he said, please, if you don't come to my house, I'll think you still believe I'm your enemy. So he was persuaded and he went to her house and she showed him this figurine of a boy. And apparently this figurine was booby-trapped and connected to a pile of hidden crossbows. And if anybody touched the figurine of the boy, it would set these crossbows off and all these crossbow arrows would be fired at whoever had touched the boy. So she said to the king, oh, well, if you touch his head, something really interesting happens. And so so curiosity killed the king. He touched the boy's head and he was then shot through by all these crossbow bolts.
I think one of the interesting things about that case, beyond the actual method of his death, is the fact that he was invited into her home on kind of good faith, really. And I guess I'm curious about the morality of that. You have a chapter in your book about the age, about how this period was an age of chivalry, but it's not really that chivalrous to bring someone into your home under good promises and then murder them.
I divided the book up into various historical periods, so the wars of religion, the age of revolution, and one I call perhaps a bit ironically the age of chivalry, which ran roughly from, say, the year 1000 to the Reformation. And one of the features, sadly, of the age of chivalry is that breach of faith was often a feature of assassination. So people went to a meeting where they believed they'd been promised safety and were then let down. There was also a disturbing trend, not just in the age of chivalry, but at other times, for people to be murdered in churches or mosques. And in the age of chivalry, I suppose one good example of a breach of faith is when the peasant revolt happened in England, 1381, and there was a man called Wat Tyler was the leader of the peasants in revolt, and King Richard II, aged only 14, was King of England. And King Richard II was in a pretty tough spot, and basically he gave way to all the peasants' demands. So whatever they wanted, yeah, get rid of serfdom, absolutely. Amnesty for everybody, no problem. And so whatever they demanded, he agreed to. And he went for a meeting with Wat Tyler in a big field, Smithfield, which is not a big field anymore, but was in those days a field outside the city of London. And Wat Tyler rode up for what he thought was a parley with the king. And the king got his one of his advisors to stab Tyler to death. And so Tyler was stabbed to death, fell from his horse, and Richard, with extraordinary coolness, you have to say, could see that Tyler's people, who were too far away to see the detail of what had happened, but could see something had gone wrong. He rode over to them and said, you want a captain? I will be your captain. Follow me. And he led them off away from the area where Tyler had been killed. And then he promptly got them surrounded by regular troops. And they were told that they'd better get home quick before it was too late. And all the promises that had been made were ripped up. And Tyler was done to death and his head was put on a spike on London Bridge so they could look at it as they went home to Kent.
We're familiar with suicide bombers today, but does this type of killer, so aka one who's willing to take his own life, crop up further back in history? Do we have examples of suicide assassinations?
Well, Machiavelli said that the hardest assassin to stop is the one who's not afraid of being killed. And if we go right back to ancient China, there is a story of a man called Prince Guang, who believed he'd been cheated out of his kingdom by his uncle, King Liao, and wanted to get revenge on King Liao. But King Liao was always very well protected. So one day, Prince Guang hired a man called Xuan Zhu, who was apparently a mountain of a man, very big man, and commissioned him to kill King Liao. And Xuan Zhu went to the lengths of learning to be a chef. He became a top chef and wormed his way into the confidence of King Liao and cooked these wonderful dishes for him. And one day he cooked this marvellous fish in which he had concealed a dagger. And so he took the fish into the king. And while everybody was enjoying the aromas that were emanating from this wonderful fish, he grabbed the dagger and stabbed the king to death. Now, he knew that the king's guards would immediately fall upon him and kill him, and they did. So that, I suppose, is one example of not exactly a suicide killing, but somebody who knew that death was almost certainly going to be the outcome of a successful assassination.
So one thing we haven't really talked about, and I'm aware that we're near the end of the podcast now, are failed assassinations. So would you mind giving our listeners some examples?
Hitler, Napoleon and Mussolini all survived assassination attempts. And Hitler, a number of assassination attempts. The most famous one, I suppose, was von Stauffenberg's plot. But that happened very late on in the war, by the time Hitler had done most of the damage that he was going to do. More tantalizing is the story of a communist carpenter called Georg Elser, who in 1939 spent months making a hidden cavity in a stone pillar in a Munich beer keller, where he knew Hitler would be speaking on the 8th of November 1939. And the reason he knew that was because the beer keller was the site of Hitler's failed putsch, his failed coup in the 1920s. And the 8th of November was the anniversary of that failed coup. So he knew that Hitler would not miss that occasion. And so he carved out this hidden cavity, put in a time bomb, and it all worked perfectly. 8th of November 1939, the time bomb went off exactly at the time that Georg Elser had planned. It brought down the ceiling on the speaker's podium, killed 8 people, but Hitler wasn't there because World War II had broken out by that point and Hitler had had to change his schedule. And so by the time the bomb exploded, he had left the building 13 minutes before. But I think the prize for failed assassinations has to go to those who tried to kill Fidel Castro. Fidel Castro actually was the subject of a documentary, which is called something like 683 Ways to Kill Castro, because that was the number of failed assassination attempts that his security services calculated had been made. And the CIA were behind a lot of those. And they tried all sorts of things. They tried exploding cigars, radio full of poison gas, a seashell that would explode at his favourite snorkelling spot. And all of them misfired. And on the very day, actually, when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, yet another attempt on Fidel Castro's life failed using a poisoned pen. So I think that he has to be, if you're looking for failures, I think the people who were trying to kill Castro probably win the gold medal. And he said, actually, if there was an Olympic event of beating assassination attempts, I would win the gold medal.
That was John Withington. His book, Assassin's Deeds, A History of Assassination from Ancient Egypt to the Present Day, is out now, published by Reaction. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in tomorrow for an episode on the military revolution on the Western Front.